This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. You're listening to Afternoons with Helen Farmer. It's all about living your best life.
On Dubai Eye 103.8.
Hi, I'm Siobhan, filling in for Helen Farmer this week. Welcome to this podcast, all about working from home injuries, fitness and bodybuilding, the impact of COVID on the lungs, keeping your brain young, Google teaming up with Safe Space to tackle mental health.
Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Good afternoon once again. I'm Siobhan Layden. If you have just joined us, I'm sitting in for Helen Farmer. Now, one of Dubai's leading and most experienced orthopaedic surgeons is seeing an increase in injuries, and it's not due to over-eager exercising or weekend warriors. It's from working from home. That's WTH injuries. With many people still working from home, what are some of the potential dangers of slumping over a dining room chair, working whilst in bed, or sitting with a laptop on your knees on the couch? Yes, well, we've all done it, me included. But it's all this repetitive stress on your neck, shoulders and hands is on the rise. So joining me now is Dr. George Vargas. He's a specialist orthopaedic surgeon based at Al Zahra Hospital. Good afternoon, Doctor. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Hi, Siobhan. Thanks for having me on the show.
It's a pleasure. So let's go on, get on with it, and let's see. I'd love to hear from you and to see if you are seeing more and more increase of people coming to you with these repetitive injuries. You've got 25 years experience, haven't you? So is this something new that you're seeing?
Absolutely. Being a sports surgeon, I was more used to having injuries due to falls, due to sport, or be it running exercise and things like that, or due to trauma. But since the pandemic has started and social distancing has been sort of enforced on people, with work from home being the norm rather than the exception, I find that there's a lot of 30 to 40% increase in the number of patients that I see in a day, which is quite a lot, with specific injuries because of working from home. Mm. And these are seen more in younger people than in the older generation. So that's interesting.
And what are some of these injuries that you're seeing?
As you rightly pointed out during the introductory statement itself, it's mostly the neck, upper back and shoulder with a little bit of lower back thrown in. Essentially, it's mainly because of the time spent with the monitor and with the gadgets that we have, with the poor work setup at home. So essentially, it's mainly people coming with not injuries per se, but discomfort because of a stiff neck, significant pain over the upper back with radiation to the front of the shoulder and the arms. Mm. And it disturbs their sleep. It can be really debilitating.
Yeah, absolutely.
Lower back was something that we always saw. But then it's the upper back and the neck and the shoulders have taken over from the lower back.
And you're correlating this directly with people working from home and perhaps not having the same chairs, desks, etc., working environment that they would normally have if they were working from an office.
Yes, that's one of the main reasons that I would see, and it would think of. Apart from that, the lack of mobility as such. So there is very little movement that happens during a day, except when you used to work from an office, there was a commuting to the office. There was the office space is divided. You move from desk to offices to offices. There is a certain amount of movement that takes place even within an office. But when you work from home, you're confined to one a single space, and then so you don't move as much, and there's a blurring of work versus your personal life. Mm. So there's no rest at all. So I would think there's a myriad of reasons why this happens. And having a bad setup, my work setup at home is just the beginning.
Yeah. And but it's quite hard, isn't it? I mean, I think I'm certainly guilty of it, sitting on the couch with a laptop on my knees. And then, you know, my wrists are sort of in the wrong position. And then
absolutely.
I get all kind of very hot lap and just really not feeling very comfortable. But it's only after you've done it that you realise, oops, I shouldn't have done it. It's kind of, you know, we should be really talking more preventative than curing it afterwards. But what can we do? I mean, you know, what can we do to prevent these injuries? I mean, we have limited access to ergonomic chairs and all these sorts of things.
Correct. I think the biggest culprit that I see are laptops and handheld devices. It's essentially, I think, is because the screen and the keyboard are connected together and you can't detach them. So if you want to look down on the screen, and then use it to text, it's hard. So the idea that it's a simple and easy way to just get a cheaper external keyboard and a mouse, whereby you effectively detach the screen and the keyboard. So if you want to raise the, because it's a laptop, if you keep it up on a table, then you have to raise your arms and your shoulders to type something. So that's not good for your shoulder or neck either. And if you want to look down, then your neck is too flexed to give yourself upper back and neck any sort of relaxation at all. The idea would be to get an external keyboard and a mouse, which can make your life a lot easier, even though the portability of the laptop is taken away, you know.
Is there sort of a rule of thumb? I was reading a little bit about ergonomics earlier, and it's apparently an ergonomics consultant calls the neutral posture or ears over shoulders over hips. So I think that's quite a nice, you know, a very simple thing for us to think about when we're sitting down. So you get your ears over your shoulders over your hips. Mm.
Correct. That's well said. Like the idea is that your feet should be touching the floor, which is begin from the floor upwards. Your knees should be slightly below your hips, so your knees are flexed at 90 and relaxed, and your feet are on the floor, touching the floor, and your hips are and your spine need not be ramrod straight, but straight with the small of the back supported, with your shoulders evenly over your hips, and your neck not flexed too far forward. And that's the biggest culprit that I find, because we tend to peer into the screen as time goes by and your neck sort of falls forward.
Mm.
And we've got exotic names for that called text neck.
Yes.
And, yeah, and we find exotic names for these. So it's very, very common to get text neck.
It's quite hard to say too, isn't it? I've heard another one as well, which is probably not quite so connected. Was it a selfie elbow?
Exactly. Yeah, I've heard that too.
So you've got a text neck, a selfie elbow. It used to be, I remember anyway. I don't know if many people will remember the BlackBerry thumbs. That used to be a big
problem. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so that's even the funny thing is that we see it even in children, because it was extremely rare to find these kind of things in children, but I'm seeing it more often than not now with children, you know, not going to school and most of the time with their phones and it's sad to see that when the child is developing, the posture needs to be as anatomical as possible. But then these sort of changes are happening even at such a young age, which can have a lasting impact. Yeah.
Healthy Habits
on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Dr. George Vargas, who's a specialist orthopaedic surgeon based at Al Zahra Hospital, is on the line. Welcome once again. Thank you for staying with us. Now, just before we left you, we talked a little bit about children and how you're seeing also some issues with children in their back and neck. And you're saying that's also directly related to possibly iPads, iPhones, potentially working, doing home learning where they're slumped over. And I can certainly talk from experience there and having to tell my children to sort of sit up properly at the table. And it's hard, actually. You know, it's very hard. I really, really do sympathise with parents who have had kids at home and trying to get them to work properly, sit at the table and, you know, not have them slumped over the couch and whatever it might be.
Right. perspective. So I would suggest that the first thing that probably should be done is to give them study corners where a dedicated space is given for studies with a table and chair with the laptop and keyboard that's separate from the laptop so that it's easier for them in case they want to move it around. Most children I find would find any space available, be it a bed or a living room or anywhere where they can loll about and do stuff. They're so flexible, and they can even stand on their head and do read something. So they would do that because that's the way children are. But if you insist that there is a study corner that they have to follow and a routine that's followed just like as if in school, and they have to sit there and not move, find another position while classes are going on is one way that I would think they would keep their posture. The other would be to give them specific time for using their phones and laptops to do things that are different from their studies, for leisure kind of. Specify the time, keep an alarm so that the alarm goes off and they know that, sort of give them a routine. And the most important would be to get them out doing exercises. We tend to ignore the importance of daily exercises for children because, we just feel that they don't need it. But the fact of the matter is that they have to get out there and move. Our body is made up of multiple moving parts, and they need to be moved just like you take a dog out for a run. A kid needs to have movement for growth. Mm. So it is important that you let them out in the find them something specific to do, get them interested in some kind of sport and follow it. So, yeah, those would be important.
And what would you recommend? Are there any particular exercises we should be doing? Because I suppose if you think about your posture, everything is moving forwards, isn't it? Your shoulders are forward, your neck's forward, everything. So I can imagine some kind of exercise where you'd be more like opening up your chest and opening up your arms.
Very true. Yes. So anything that would move the body in all the planes that it is capable of moving would be, so any, it can be even whatever you're passionate about, even just routine dancing, any sort of dance form is fine, but stretches, if you're not interested in any kind of sport, any stretches. But as children, it's always better to give them something that they can improve on. So if you just say just do stretches, it's not interesting for them. So give them a dance form or something that allows them to improve in whatever they're doing. And in the process, you get the benefit of the stretches too. Mm. So be it swimming, ballet, dances and things like that. Yeah, I always found that you tell a child to do something specifically for the sake of exercise, it's very hard to get them to do it because there's no motivation.
Yeah. But I suppose get them. I know that even mine a bit at school. They've been doing. I don't know what it's called actually. It's called the Wii thing where you copy the people dancing on the screen, and they love actually. They absolutely love it. It's a good one to do. And I suppose if you have time and parents can join in that as well. But I'd also like to sort of touch on now. Also, I mean, are you seeing any sort of long term effects from, or do you think there will be any potential long term effects from? From sitting down in these positions and not just generally because of lockdown and because of our certain circumstances, but just in general from constantly being on some kind of a device, be it an iPhone, an iPad or a laptop.
Absolutely. Like we actually underestimate the amount of changes that can happen to a body by constantly having the wrong posture. So it is important, even in a child specifically, when it's like a growing sapling. And if you guide the sapling the right way, the tree will grow to be, the way you want it to. So in a child, if you don't assess give them the importance of holding their position and their posture, especially in young girls, because the growth spurt happens very quickly in young girls. And while it's happening between the ages of 12 to 14, and that's the age that, you tend to be shy. And then it's very important for them to hold their posture and make their muscles supple as well as strong. and make sure that the posture is kept ready, is corrected.
Just really quickly, before we let you go, quick question. If you were to buy something, I'd say that would help your posture, what would it be? If you could just buy one thing?
I would probably buy a resistance band.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, because the resistance band, like you just told me earlier, it actually, you can use it to open up your body much more than weights, free weights. So a resistance band actually has got so many benefits with it that I would probably suggest a resistance band. The way you go about it, there are millions of ways you can do that. It's too short a time for me to tell you.
Yeah.
But then I would certainly say a resistance band would go a long way. Yeah.
That's really good advice. Thank you so much for joining us today, Dr. Jorge Vargas. It's been a pleasure. Thanks for joining us. Specialist orthopedic surgeon based at Al Zahra Hospital.
Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
And up next, I'm really looking forward to having a chat with Mr. Wales, Mr. England and Mr. London. That's all one person, though. Bodybuilding champion. He's got over 15 years of fitness knowledge and he is ready to answer your questions today on how to keep motivated, setting routines and sticking to them, and any other questions you may have about fitness and bodybuilding. Christian Williams, Dubai-based fitness coach, personal trainer and bodybuilder. Great to have you on the show today. Thanks for joining us, Christian.
Thank you, and I'm looking forward to trying to win that seashell kind of vacation.
Me too. That'd be quite nice, wouldn't it? So I just want to get straight into it with you, because I've got so many questions I'd like to talk to you about. But I was on your website, obviously doing a bit of research, and you have quite an interesting story, don't you, Christian? Because I believe it was really the start of your fitness journey. And you say that you were sort of quite overweight at school and really not feeling very happy with yourself. But you were determined to get fit and to transform yourself, which you did. But what was it that got you motivated in the first place? And what was it that really pushed you to achieve your goal?
Okay, so like most people, I started off wanting to improve the way I looked because I wanted to improve the way I felt. And when I was a young child, I came from quite a rough town of South Wales and there was not a lot of role models in place. And, you know, we would always eat just anything we could get our hands on. We'd get into, you know, fights and so forth. So being big was kind of like being big, Mr. Big Guy. So, you know, I spent the first couple of years of my teenage life just, you know, playing sports, and the weight actually helped me perform. I was never severely overweight, but I was always a chubby kid. And it was one defining moment when my life started changing the right direction, I guess, and moving from the wrong direction. I was actually sat down with a girl I had a crush on in school, and she said something about the way I looked, which made me really upset and quite hungry, to be honest. And I was walking home from school that afternoon. I was 15 years old. It was the last day of school before I broke up for the six-week summer holidays. And I was like, man, you know, you are getting overweight, out of shape, and everybody is nobody you want to notice. So I made a decision in that moment to only eat foods I considered good for me. And my education was very poor at the time, but I knew what was not good for me. So I made the decision to cut out them foods. I go running every day. I would do press-ups and sit-ups. I wanted to come back after 6 weeks and show everybody what I can achieve. I came back 6 weeks later after fully committing, and I left as a chubby kind of overweight schoolboy, and I came back as like a fitness fanatic. Honestly, I was probably the only boy in school with a ripped six-pack, and everybody noticed the transformation. Obviously, that girl also, but my grades improved, my energy levels improved. I was made captain of the football team, the rugby team, and I just started gaining a lot of confidence, and I knew that the fitness lifestyle was a gateway into success. Mm. What that kind of transition did for me was it taught me two very valuable kind of lessons that I tried to teach many people. And one is that what we can achieve if we just fully commit, and actually how fast we can achieve it if we are fully committed to consistently doing what we need to do.
I think it's just such an interesting, great story. Thank you so much, first of all, Christian, for sharing that with us. And I think that is a real motivation for many. You know, you didn't come from a background of where you had access to all these sorts of things. It really came from within. And what's interesting, not just that you achieved something physical, but was that you also, you felt mentally that you felt better, did better at school, you felt more confident in yourself. And so it's this whole holistic results, isn't it, I suppose, from just starting to even just get fit physically.
Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
I'm joined by Christian Williams, Dubai-based fitness coach, personal trainer and bodybuilder. As we mentioned, I think a lot of us have struggled with working from home, with a change of lifestyle, obviously, from what's been going on over the past, well, over a year now. Many have perhaps gained weight. We've just got completely out of any of our fitness routines. Christian, what do you think you should do first? I mean, if people listening today are going, oh, I really need to get back, I really need to get motivated, what would be the first piece of advice that you perhaps would offer or suggest?
Well, the first piece of advice is to take action, move. You know, what we see now, we've seen a trend of, you know, people being sat down most of the day. They literally leave in the bed, they jump in behind the desk, and, you know, sitting down in a bad position for many hours a day is going to lead to many conditions, you know, not just the lower back, some digestive issues, you know, potentially rupturing discs. So we need to move more than ever. We need to get the body working, the metabolism firing. We need to increase insulin sensitivity. Otherwise, the food we eat is literally just going to store as fat. So my first advice to anybody is get up and move. The first part of your day, take control of that. If you go for a walk, if you want to do some exercise, do some stretching, do something that is actually for you. Otherwise, you feel a little bit of a resentment to your workplace as well, because you're getting up and diving into that seat straight away.
Yeah. We just had a really nice message come through, actually. Let me read it out for you, Christian. He says, Chris is fantastic. He helped me at the age of 40 achieve incredible results that I would never have been able to do on my own. He isn't just motivating. He is logical and precise and is able to... where are we? Obliterate any obstacle in your path with wisdom and knowledge. I don't have a name on that, but that's really lovely. That's nice to hear. Nice boost for you as well. But you decided to go down the path of bodybuilding, and extreme bodybuilding. Now, I've said you are Mr. London, is it? Mr. England, Mr. Wales. All in one. I mean, you're pretty impressive. I've seen the pictures. how do you maintain such a physique? I mean, how many hours do you spend yourself working on just maintaining that physique?
Well, my goals are a lot different now than obviously when I was winning championships and competing. There was a lot of dedication. There was a lot of hours spent. Now, in all honesty, the training I do every day is more of an asset to the way I feel. You know, I use energy. And in return, I gain energy. So now it's around 1.5 hours a day, every day. And again, it's a really good stress relief. So I'm very busy as well. I'm running a business that's growing. I'm helping many people out. So for me, it's a really good way to deload that stress. When I was competing and winning these championships, it was the same duration of time I would spend. But it's not about the quantity like anything else. It's about the quality of where you spend it. And this is where we go into the question a lot of people will say is, you know, one of the biggest reasons people don't work out is because they don't have the time. It's not about, you know, it's not about finding the time. It's about utilizing the little time you do have.
So let's answer that then. So I would say someone has got obviously very, very busy, out in the morning, back late at night. First of all, what would you do in sort of 15 minutes? And secondly, should you do that in the morning or should you do it in the evening or even at lunchtime? What would be perhaps the optimal time to do some physical exercise?
Okay, so the best time to do it, because I get asked this question all the time, is whatever time suits you. Literally, whatever 15-minute gap you have. And another question is that enough? Now, think of it like this. There's actually three ways to take a tree down. You can actually grab a saw and you can saw that tree down and it might take 3 hours. Or you can grab an axe, and providing the axe is sharp, you can take it down in maybe like an hour and a half. Or you grab a chainsaw and you could probably take that chainsaw and that tree down in a few minutes. So if you are limited with the time, you just have to make sure that time is utilized the most efficient way you can. So then things like high-intensity workouts where you actually rest in very minimum, you're keeping the heart rate going, you're doing functional full-body movements, and you don't need a lot of space to do this either.
Yeah. And what about not being able to have weights? Or say you don't have any weights at home. What else would you recommend that you can actually use instead of weights? I mean, you could use your own body weight, I suppose.
Yeah, of course. You can use your body weight. You can do some endurance things. If you wanted to make a small investment, the TRX, which is TRX, is a great bit of suspension training kit that you can just tie on the door and you can train your full body with resistance using this. Now, I want to just, you know, expand on this question a little bit. Now, most people don't want to use weights because they get fearful they're going to get bulky. But like I mentioned, a lot of people's posture now, they get a tight hamstrings, they get a rounded lower back, they get severely tight in the chest because being sat down all day long. So the resisted training is actually going to help bring that posture back in line. You know, doing some movements to work the inner back and the rhomboids, I think, is vital. But to answer the question in the short, you don't need any equipment at all. You need the time, you need the commitment to that time, and then you need to just be consistent.
Oh, OK. I've got loads more questions, but I'm sorry we're going to have to leave it there, Christian. Perhaps we'd love to get you back on the show another time. It was so interesting, and you've got such a great story, I think, and a great commitment. You're also it's a standard. You're part of Toastmasters. You're fantastic with motivation, achieving goals and all sorts of things. So it would be wonderful to talk to you more at a later time. But Christian Williams, thank you for your time today. He's a physical trainer and also a bodybuilder. That's Christian Williams.
Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Good afternoon. Well, up next, as we know, one of the main organs that COVID-19 can affect and has affected many is the lungs. But how does this happen? Why does it happen? And what are some of the potential lasting impacts it can have on those who have had it? Joining us on the line now is Dr. Arshad Altaf, specialist pulmonologist at Prime Medical Center, to answer all your questions. Dr. Altaf, thank you so much for joining us.
Most welcome. Thanks a lot for having me there today.
It's a pleasure. I'll just start off simply, really. But how can COVID affect the lungs?
Well, like COVID is a viral infection, as we know very well. And the most important target for the viral infection is the lungs, because the receptors there are more prominent on the lung surfaces. And it affects basically by having pneumonias in the lungs. It starts with a pneumonia. It can progress with low oxygen levels. It can further progress where the patient might need a ventilator. But luckily, good enough of the patients don't require such a thing. And it is mild for most of the patients, but unfortunately 20 to 30% of the patients do have pneumonias, which can progress over time.
Mm. And of course, we know that people who have such things as asthma or allergies, they could perhaps, do you think, have more likely to have potentially longer lasting impacts of COVID?
Yeah, definitely. Because all the patients who have chronic respiratory diseases like asthma, COPD or ILDs or interstitial lung diseases, they are more prone to have severe forms of COVID, wherein lungs are affected more badly as compared to those who are healthy and who don't have any chronic illnesses.
Mm. How about smokers? Are they more likely to experience worse symptoms?
Definitely. Smoking, it's really bad for the lungs. And we have seen that smokers having very severe lung diseases because of COVID.
Mm. So, and if you have any allergies, we know a lot of people suffer from asthma and allergies here in the region. Could they also potentially have perhaps worse effects, or if they do get COVID, or a lasting impact?
Definitely. In asthmatics, what happens, there are two ways of involvement. One is if they get COVID, they might develop a rapid pneumonia and lead to the problems in the lungs wherein oxidation is affected. And those, in fact, who don't have a severe disease with COVID, they can have a wheezing episode like any other viral illnesses, like we had influenza before, which can trigger wheezing in such patients. Similar can happen with COVID as well. Mm. Without getting pneumonias, they can get wheezing episodes, their asthma control can worsen, they might require urgent attention for their asthma as well.
So are there any things that coronavirus patients can do to increase their chances for less severe lung damage?
Well, the best thing I would suggest is try to have a way in which you don't get the infection. Follow the basic precautions. That's the best way to deal with it. But then, of course, some vitamins might boost up immunity, although we are not so sure about the effects of vitamin C over the lungs and all. People have been taking so long. But then, most important thing, follow the basic things like the hand washing, masking up, physical distancing, and of course, vaccination, which is going to be going to play a very, very important role in the coming days.
Mm. And is COVID-19 lung damage reversible? You know, so you do have, you have got damaged lungs, you have had COVID. Is it something that can repair itself over time?
Well, I will say most of the patients do repair their lungs of their own over time. Some require treatment, but unfortunately, some who had a very severe illness wherein ventilation was required, they were put on ventilators or had like oxygen levels low for a long, long time, needing hospitalization for a longer time. Such patients sometimes do develop pulmonary fibrosis, which is one of the, like, say it in simpler terms, like it's a scarring of lungs, which unfortunately might be an irreversible thing also. Like, we don't have clear-cut answers right now. It's been too early for us to be answering such questions. Just 1 year over the line, and we'll see these things, whether they are reversing over time or any specific therapies, if they are helping them out in such a situation.
Mm. So right now, you're really not sure if it is reversible or not, but it can be sort of, let's say, stabilised.
Yeah, it can be stabilised, but the damage which might have happened to some of the lungs might unfortunately remain there for a longer time. And in fact, some medicines might help, some might not. But fortunately, a very few percentage of the people are developing such kind of complications, which we term as post-COVID interstitial lung diseases or a post-COVID pulmonary fibrosis, which is usually not a good thing to have, unfortunately, right now. Yeah.
Yeah. And what about those so-called sort of long haulers, or those who've had what's been called post-COVID-19 syndrome or long COVID-19? I have friends actually who had it in the very beginning, and months and months and months later, they were still struggling. Just out of breath, not really much energy, really struggling to get back to their normal routines. Even their son had it, and he couldn't play football. It took a long time, and they're still not 100%. They're still not 100% back to what they were before.
Yeah, this is a very good and a relevant question for most of the patients who might have these symptoms for a longer time, which was being called as long COVID, now recently being termed as a post-acute COVID syndrome. And it usually what happens with COVID, within 3 to 4 weeks, most of the patients do recover, have less symptoms, but unfortunately some can have symptoms longer. Like when it's up to 12 weeks, we call it a subacute COVID. And if it lasts more than 12 weeks, going into months, even up to 6 months, we call it a chronic COVID or a long COVID. And for these patients, the most common symptom is fatigue and shortness of breath. And the mechanisms still are not clear, like how it's happening, most likely effect of a post-inflammatory change because of the viral infection, and sometimes some thrombotic effects also.
Mm. What kind of treatments are you looking at offering now?
Well, for these kind of patients, we have to go in details in evaluating them and seeing what are the causes. Like the breathing difficulties can be because of the lungs, because of the heart, and it has to be evaluated. They need to consult their doctors, and definitely there are some lung function tests, which we call as pulmonary function tests. And a simple test, one of the simple tests among the pulmonary function tests, is a 6-minute walk test, wherein we ask the patient to have a 6-minute brisk walk and then check his oxygen saturations, his heart rates, pulse, and other vitals over these 6 minutes, continuously monitor them and see how they are behaving in such a test. Mm. And then there are tests for capacities of the lungs, which can delineate whether it's the lung which is affected or is it because of some other causes.
Yeah.
Or sometimes the patients can even have a post-traumatic stress disorder post-COVID, wherein their lungs might be healthy, their heart might be healthy, but still they might perceive a breathlessness as well. So these kind of things, anxiety and depression, can also play a role in many of the patients who have spent time in ICUs, spent time in hospitals alone for many, many days and months, in fact, some of them.
I can certainly imagine that. Doctor, we've had some questions come through from our listeners now. Leela has asked, so some people say that even if you have mild COVID symptoms, you could have serious lung issues post-recovery. Is this true? She said, my husband has been diagnosed, but is almost asymptomatic. However, he has a history of asthma.
Well, for those patients who are asymptomatic, usually very less chances of getting a severe long COVID. But the factors which usually are seen to, for like those factors which are prominent in having in them is if they are having more symptoms, they are females, and if their age is more, like with we have seen that elderly group population have longer symptoms. But asymptomatic patients usually don't have severe, like severe lung involvement.
Okay.
That has not been seen till now, yeah.
Marnie texts in saying, today I ran 3 kilometres in 28 minutes. To some, this may look like an unsuccessful run. However, to me, this is my post-COVID lung reality. Will my lungs ever go back to normal, or is it too early to tell, or am I a long hauler? Yeah, this, we discussed this earlier, a little bit earlier, didn't we, Doctor? What would you say to Marnie?
Well, I would say that he should keep on trying, doing a bit of exercise more and more, gradually increasing his pace of run, and just have a look on the saturations. Whether he is still desaturating, I would personally recommend him to buy a pulse oximeter, keep on track over after the runs, how his saturation is remaining, whether it's within the normal range. And of course, he is going to, inshallah, recover soon, and he definitely growing over time.
Okay, so sorry, you mentioned to buy something there. So can you just mention that again? What would that be?
Well, it's a small portable device to check the handheld device to check the oxygen saturations, which checks the level of oxygen in the blood.
Right.
A simple device which can be put in the finger and it can give you a reading.
Okay.
Whether it's, if it is more than 96, 97, it's absolutely normal. So you can try it using, I hope if he has been already had one and he's been using it, that would be great to know.
Mm. And that would just give you an idea, really, I suppose, of the saturation levels and of, you know, if you're improving or not. I mean, is there a level that you should never go under or over?
Of course. Yeah, like under, of course. Over, probably he won't go, of course. And then if he's going under, he needs to meet his doctor to decide whether his exercise is appropriate to his lung health.
Mm.
So for him, I would suggest to check and then definitely meet the doctor and decide on what kind of an exercise will be best suited for these kind of patients.
Yeah.
And we usually have a program which we call a pulmonary rehabilitation program for those patients who have had a very severe lung like problem during COVID. For them, a regular program of exercise, physiotherapy, exercises for the lungs can be devised by the specialist along with the respiratory physiotherapist. I would suggest him to meet his doctor and decide on what will be the best suited thing for him.
Right. Good advice there. Thank you, doctor. And Ushus has texted saying, I recovered from COVID and I had very mild symptoms. I am asthmatic. If or when I have an asthma attack, can I just resort to my trusty nebulizer inhaler or do I need to do more?
For asthmatics, I would first recommend that they should be on their controller inhalers regularly. That means there are medicines which are used to control asthma attacks in the form of inhalers. They should not skip the doses. They should be regular with the doses. And definitely, if there is a need of increase or decrease in the treatment, it depends on how they are on their regular treatment. And nebulizations, as the caller has mentioned, is needed only for an acute attack. If they are not controlled with regular medications, definitely nebulization might help to alleviate the symptoms at that time. But regular controllers is always needed to control the long-term symptoms of asthma.
Okay, so definitely keep those handy and definitely stocked up. And you don't really need to, as you said, do more, but just continue what you're doing.
Yeah, of course.
Another question's come through. Thanks, everybody. Hayley says, what breathing exercises can you recommend for post-COVID recovery patients? That's a great question.
Yeah, really a very good and interesting question. And I would suggest for them, one is the simple deep breathing exercises wherein they can take a deep breath and hold for a few seconds, then exhale through an open mouth. But then if they can buy an incentive spirometer, that's a small device which has columns and it has some balls inside the columns wherein they can inhale and exhale in the machine. It's a small handheld device and it gives a back pressure to the lungs. That means we are doing an exercise for the lungs against a resistance, like you do for your body against a resistance to exercise your body. Similar is a device for the lungs as well. It's a tri-ball device called an incentive spirometer that will be really helpful for recovery of the patients post-COVID to exercise their lungs, to make their lungs healthy sooner.
Mm-hmm. That's okay. I think I've seen those actually where you blow into them. Yeah. So by doing that regularly, could you improve your lung capacity?
Yes, of course, definitely. And I would suggest all those patients who've been discharged from the hospitals after a longer time needing oxygen, they should be using incentive spirometers regularly to improve on their lung capacities.
Mm. I'm just wondering as well, obviously we're coming into summer. Well, not quite, but the temperatures certainly have risen. The ACs are on. There's been a lot of dust particles in the air recently as well. Could that have some impact on breathing capacities, do you think?
Well, hydration definitely is most important. Patients for post-COVID recovery, they should have, keep themselves hydrated, protect themselves from all kinds of allergens, particularly those who have like attacks of allergies and wheezing episodes. So dust, pollen, smoking, of course, these are really important to be careful about. Even though in the dust within the house, things, dust, mites, and all are common triggers for the allergies. So these things have to be taken care of.
Yeah. And final question for you has just come through from Ritu. She says, my son recovered from COVID in January 2021. It was largely an asymptomatic attack. I recently did an antibodies test. Can you explain certain values and what does it mean to have a 183.3 U/mL antibodies? How long will he be safe with these values?
Well, post-COVID antibody tests usually give an idea about the immunity status of a patient once he's recovering from COVID or if he has taken a vaccination. So if his levels are 180 and above, what he has mentioned, usually this kind of an level gives him a protection. But usually this protection wanes over time. So maybe in 3 months, 4 months, there are no clear-cut answers for the time duration, how long he will be having this kind of antibodies. But then I would still recommend if it was an asymptomatic infection, a mild one, he might still require to be vaccinated for a lasting immunity. Because we have seen vaccinations give a longer term immunity as compared to the recovery from an infection.
Let's just have a quick recap, if we may, before we get into more questions. And there was something that you mentioned, and I'm sorry, I can't remember the name of it. It was like a little device that you breathe into that can, if you have had COVID and you're still struggling with breathing, it's basically, I suppose, like a muscle that needs exercising and needs retraining. Is that right?
Exactly. The retraining of the lungs to increase the capacities, increase the volumes of the volumes of the air which can breathe in and out. For that, it requires a retraining, and the device which I had mentioned before, the incentive spirometer, is one of the devices, although there are multiple more, which the respiratory physiotherapists can definitely advise the patients. They should take an appointment and meet and discuss their problems in detail with the therapist, and he can then explain them the use of the device and which device suits them the best.
Loads more questions coming through for you, Doctor. Aya has said, I have recovered from COVID but still coughing and feel congested in the chest. Do I still have to check my oxygen on the pulse oximeter?
Well, actually, we have to see how long she means that she has recovered, how long it has been since her symptoms. If it has been like it's more than 4 to 6 weeks of her coughing, definitely she needs an attention. She needs to visit a doctor for that. She might require some imaging and some tests to see why the cough is not reducing. About the oxygen level, if she has a home health oximeter, definitely it's a good idea to check. It's one of the recommendations now. Even FDA says for long haulers that one of the simplest way to check for their status is to check oxygen saturations at home. So, but then I would advise her to meet a doctor for a persistent cough. If it's bothering her and she feels congested as well, she needs an attention for that.
Right. Okay. Thanks very much. And no name on this one, though, but saying I have had COVID twice, gosh, and each time in the ICU. Gosh, sorry to hear that. Feeling better now, but is there something I can do to care for my lungs? Well, yeah, maybe again, just a very quick recap on the various different things that you said. I mean, for those who have had COVID, for those who aren't feeling 100% and still are wheezing or still having issues, what's the best thing for them to do?
Yeah, really unfortunate for him to get it twice. The same thing which I said before, like the immunity wanes if it's only by an infection over time, maximum in 3-4 months usually we have seen. So I hope that he had vaccinated after his first infection. He might have been better protected to get this, like not to get the infection once again. So again, the same protection we have to understand. Like even if we are vaccinated or had an infection before, the basic principles remain the same. We need to mask up. We need to maintain the physical distance and hygiene. This is going to be a long run for the fight against this pandemic, actually. Because to vaccinate all the population, around 70-80% needs to be vaccinated to have a protection which we call herd immunity. And I think maximum by now we might have achieved around 30%, and it's still long time to go. So we cannot lower the guard. In fact, lowering the guard, we have seen that some people, they got vaccinated first dose and they started to like take it lightly, and then they got unfortunately the infection.
Mm.
So we have to be careful about it.
Right. A final question for you, Doctor, if I may. I know we're running out of time, but last question for you comes through from Jake, and he says, I had COVID a few months ago with moderate symptoms. I was coughing for about 5 days, and after my isolation period, I went to my family physician and she checked my breathing and declared my lungs clear. Should I do more than that? Should I have an X-ray, perhaps?
If he has visited the doctor and then he has been cleared that his lungs clear, then definitely he should not be worried about it unless he develops a new symptom.
Right.
Maybe a newborn or a fever, then definitely he should visit. Otherwise, no need for immediate.
Okay.
No X-ray study.
Thank you so much, Doctor. I'm sorry, the line just started to break a little bit there at the end. But yeah, just to recap there, Jake. So he said it should be fine and would no need to go back again, obviously, unless you are feeling that you have more symptoms or worsening symptoms. But big thank you to Dr. Arshad from the Prime Medical Centre for joining us on the line and asking and answering all of those questions.
Healthy Habits
on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Good afternoon. Next, I'm looking forward to having a chat with our next guest. She is a regular on the programme. It's Dr. Thuraya Kanafani, clinical psychologist and co-owner of the Human Relations Institute in Dubai. Let's start with a little quote. Mark Twain apparently said once, "Age is an issue of mind over matter. If you don't mind, it doesn't matter." However, according to a growing body of research, there is more to it than that. Our subjective age, how old we feel, has a very real impact on health and longevity. People who feel younger than their years can often actually are in terms of how long they have left to live. Dr. Thuraya, it's always great to have you join on the show. Thanks very much. How are you? How old are you feeling today? Or how young are you feeling today, I should ask you?
Well, I think today is not a great day for you to ask me that question.
Why? It's Tuesday. We're almost end of the week.
No, actually, it's because I recently was in the hospital for emergency surgery. So I have definitely felt my age in the past few weeks.
Oh.
But thankfully recovering and slowly getting back to feeling like my better age, my mental age.
Well, I hope so. I'm sorry to hear that. Yeah.
No, it's fine.
You know, it's interesting, isn't it? Whenever anything, I suppose, happens like that, major or minor, it's only then that we really, truly, I think, value our health and
absolutely
feeling good about it.
Or
are
at least reminded.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I think that's a big one. Sometimes we forget how important that is and how like everything else gets put on hold without that. So
absolutely. Yeah. Well, great to have you on the show today. Thanks so much for joining
Thank
us.
Thank you.
So I'm interested about this subjective age. What is your subjective age and how do we control it or possibly even change it?
Well, your subjective age is pretty much the age that you feel. So obviously we have our chronological age, which is the age of our, you know, whatever year it is, subtracted by your year of birth or birth year. But your subjective age is how you experience life and how you feel. And so through subjective age, it can actually make a really big difference on how your body responds to your experience as you get older. But that's not it, though. That's not enough. I know a lot of people are like, you know what, if you feel young, that's good. That's all you really need. That's not actually accurate. A lot of people have that mindset, but that's not really true. What you actually have to do is keep your brain young so that you can match your subjective age.
Mm. And how can we do that? I mean, let's get down to it. These are some of the, apparently, the tricks, or we can trick our brain into feeling young. Please tell us.
There are quite a few different ways. And a lot of these ways are really backed up by research and by studies, you know, because when we look at the brain, if I can, Siobhan, just to kind of go back and subtract, or rewind a bit to how we're born. So our brain is actually super interesting. We are born with most of the neurons that we will ever need in our life when we are actually born. And this usually happens prenatally, so before we are actually born, when we are developing within the womb. Now, after we're born, these billions of neurons that we have, and then, of course, the synapses that start forming because we're forming all of these connections, we're looking at this person and that person, we're starting to understand things. All of these things are kind of creating and strengthening different learnings in our brain. And as long as we continue to do that, our brain stays strong. But unfortunately, what ends up happening is that as we get older, especially from childhood to like teenage years and then into adulthood, we start to focus on different things in our lives. So we're actually getting rid of, unfortunately, what happens is that when we're very, very young, we have so many different connections. But as we get older, these connections start to be kind of like, if you will, weeded out because we're no longer using them like we used to when we were kids. And when we're kids, we're far more inquisitive, we're looking, we're exploring. But as we get older, we kind of, you hone in on like the math, the science, the English, and then you get old, a little bit more, you go to university, you study one thing. And so because we're not using so many different connections in our brain, they're actually minimizing. So what ends up happening is that our brain starts to slowly deteriorate, if you will, if we're going to use that word right now. So in order for us to trick our brain, we're not actually tricking it. We're just kind of, if you will, giving it a little bit of a boost again, because it actually really works well when it comes to learning. So, as long as you keep your brain active with reading, taking new courses, word puzzles, math problems, craft activities, learning something new, this is so important because what you're doing is you're actually creating more connections and using connections that haven't been used in such a long time before they weed out. And, that's one of the difficulties that you'll usually find with individuals who experience Alzheimer's is that even in the initial stages, their connections drop significantly, almost from 30,000 per milliliter to 20,000 per milliliter in terms of like neurons. And that is massive. That's a 30% reduction in the very first stage of the disease. And so what we're trying to get people to understand is, the more you use your brain, the less likely these neurons and these connections will minimize, and thus, you can always keep your brain young.
I suppose, if you think of it like a muscle as well, they say you have to exercise it to keep it fit, to keep it healthy. And can I ask you though, we're not going to survive our whole lives with the same amount of neurons, or maybe we are. But
of course.
But can you just sort of dust them off and they can come to life again?
No.
Oh.
It doesn't work like that. Okay. However, as time passes and the less we use, the more that deteriorates, right? So essentially what we're trying to do in order to keep the brain young, it means keeping the brain active. And that, like I said, it's about learning something new, getting physical exercise. Exercising regularly actually increases the number of tiny blood vessels, which bring oxygen-rich blood to the area of the brain that's responsible for thought process. So it keeps us alert. It keeps us active. It keeps us refreshed. Also dieting. Dieting is so important when you focus more on things like fruits and vegetables, fish, nuts, unsaturated oils, plant sources for proteins. All of these help with, minimize cognitive impairment, dementia, so on and so forth. Maintaining mental health is extremely important. Of course, I am slightly biased as a psychologist, but it is very important because it helps keep your brain young, because it actually decreases the risk of cognitive decline, and it helps with memory.
We've had some really nice messages come through. I asked at the beginning of the program, what makes you feel young and what makes you feel old? And Jeanette has texted in saying, listening to 80s and 90s songs makes me feel young. Love it. Do you know, it was really interesting because I was just doing some, obviously, research before the program, and I was reading about this study that was in 2010. It was a Harvard psychologist called Dr. Ellen Langer took a group of celebrities to a retreat for a BBC program. Not sure if you've heard about this.
No.
So the retreat was furnished from 1980, and all the magazines, radio shows and TV programs were all from the 80s. Oh, you'd love this, Jeanette. And each person wore a badge of themselves from 1980. So before leaving, the group underwent tests to determine their age, including grip, vision, hearing, balance, hormones, muscle thoughts, etc., etc. And then the group all spent a week living as if it was 30 years earlier. So everything going around them was engineered to enable them to act as though they had as though it was like 30 years ago, subconsciously tricking themselves to believe they were younger. And after 7 days, they took the same tests again, and they all had reversed their age by a minimum of 7 to 10 years and had a new lease of life. And when asked to describe what had happened, they reported forgetting they were older. And as a result, they physically grew younger.
Right, right. Fantastic. And that's a big part of that mental health factor, right? And it's actually interesting that the person that messaged in talking about music and listening to older music, actually listening to music is very important because the brain has a lot to do, has a lot of computing to do when you're trying to make sense of music, because music is really structural and mathematical. So it really helps with memory. When you're actually listening to music, and especially music that you heard when you were younger.
Yeah, I totally agree. And even perhaps playing music too. I always wanted to play the piano, and last year I finally got around to it.
Well, congratulations.
Well, I didn't go very well. I mean, I had my lessons, then sadly COVID happened and I couldn't continue. I mean, that's no excuse. I could do it at home, I'm sure. However, just one point to sort of think about, I was, oh my gosh, I really did feel my brain was old. It was so hard. I felt like it was like this really unoiled cog or something, trying to sort of get both hands on different fingers and just to remember the notes and to remember everything. And it was really hard. And I'm sure it wouldn't be as hard as that when I was younger. But I did feel that I was kind of, I don't know, I was exercising my brain, literally was exercising my brain through trying to learn to play the piano. So, yeah, I suppose things like that, learning music, listening to music, things like that. We've had another message come through also. Let's see. And they say, what makes me feel younger is when I lift weights in the gym more than most young people and much more than when I was in 20s. I'm 44 now. Good for you. Still going strong.
Yeah. You know, engaging actually in activities that keep your health better is actually very important. And also engaging in activities that you kind of enjoyed when you were younger is really important too, because, you know, pretty much exactly like the show that you had described, when you kind of dress like you did when you were younger, or like have that mental kind of nostalgia of going back, it gives you a lot of that boost of what we were talking about in the beginning, which was the subjective age.
Yeah, and I wanted to ask this one. It's good to get your feedback on this. Joe has messaged in asking, hi, Dr. Thrower, are brain training apps like Elevate and Luminosity beneficial for the brain?
So I don't know much about Elevate, but Luminosity definitely does. I've actually used it myself. Mm. It can be very beneficial for many different reasons, but the main reason is because A, not only are you keeping your brain active, but you're also learning new things. And with Luminosity, and actually I think Elevate has this too, if I'm not mistaken, if I remember seeing it properly, it has like different types of, so like some things are for memory, some things are for like mathematics, some things are for puzzles, like things like that. So all of these different games gives your brain an opportunity to continue doing something novel, continue doing something interesting. And it also uses different parts of your brain for different activities.
Mm-hmm.
So these things can be extremely helpful.
Right. Oh, great. Maybe try them. I'll get some of those, see if they work. Do you know, I was listening to this podcast the other day, and it really made me think, and I just thought it was really wonderful. It was by Ken Robinson, who is an educationalist, and he was very famous for his TED talk, I think, on creativity and education. And he was talking about when he once met the Dalai Lama. He was at some event or something, and the Dalai Lama told him something like, I think it was something along the lines of, to be born at all is a miracle. So what are you going to do with your life? He says, mm-hmm. never regret growing old. It's a privilege denied to many. So don't while away your time. Real happiness comes from things that fulfill you. And I just thought that was so impactful, you know. Yeah. Never regret growing old. It's a privilege denied to many. And it's just so true, isn't it?
It is, especially I think after, you know, everything that everyone's experienced from around the world in the past year, I think this even more so becomes something that we need to consider again.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So what else? What would you also perhaps advise to stay young? Also keep your brain young. Have you heard of these? Is it neurobotics? It's like aerobics, but it's for your brain.
Yes, I have. Actually, like I said, anything that keeps you active and keeps your brain doing something new and something different, it's very important. But equally, we also have to focus on your physical health, right?
Yeah.
So things like maintaining a good night's sleep, this is very important for improved memory, performance, productivity, and health. I mean, there are so many studies that have shown that individuals that get less than 7 to 8 hours of sleep have an increased risk of stroke, heart disease, and even brain decline, slow brain, cognitive decline. So maintaining a night routine, avoiding screens and caffeine intake when closer to bedtime is so important. But equally, reducing stress, right? Letting go of how things, you know, we would want things to be or should be, releasing that idea of control, working on, like I said, mental health, you know, your anxiety, your stress, you know, these kinds of mental health difficulties could make you feel older because you have lower energy as well and you're not really doing much for yourself. At times, it's also important to give your brain a rest. So it's not just about learning new things and doing things, but it's also about kind of taking a pause, you know,
yeah.
Because giving your brain a rest helps kind of decrease stress, as well as it decreases the chances of things like burnout and feeling exhausted and so on and so forth. So, you know, taking a break could mean anything like going for a walk. It could be like watching, you know, your favorite TV show. Obviously, you want to do this in moderation because I know the tendency now is to kind of binge watch like so many things and just turn your brain off, which is very unhealthy. The idea is to kind of keep like a little bit of a balance. So exercise your brain, but equally at the same time, allow it to rest. But I think one of the most significant things that could really help with keeping you feeling young and even your brain feeling young is something that even was mentioned in the Japanese book that was released a couple of years back, The Ikigai.
Oh, yeah.
Which is a great book. It talks about building social networks, like maintaining healthy connections because, you know, that lowers blood pressure and creates longer life expectancy. But it also helps you keep young because when you're surrounded by people that you care about and surrounded by people that you love, you actually are motivated to do new things, to try new things. And that can actually help you not just physically, but also mentally feel young.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And I think, again, as you mentioned earlier, Dr. Thoreau, now more than ever this year, certainly I think for many, made us realize the importance of those connections, maybe just simple connections, physical connections, in-person connections, just having friends and family around you. It's so important, isn't it?
Right. Absolutely. I mean, it's something that I think for a long time, and I think this is just natural with humans, is that we take things that we have for granted, especially when we only know the value of things when we start to lose things around us and or within ourselves. And I think this year has really put a spotlight to the fact that we should really, really appreciate just the fact of being alive and appreciate for those of us who have good health and so on and so forth.
Dr. Thoreau, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much for sharing your insights and experience with us today on the program. Great to have you on the show.
Thank you, Siobhan.
Thanks very much. And keep feeling young, and I hope you're back to full health very soon.
Thank you. Thank you.
Dr. Thoreau Kanafani there, clinical psychologist and co-owner of the Human Relations Institute in Dubai. Thanks very much for joining us.
Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Coming up, what's the first thing most of us do if we want to find out more about something? Well, we Google it. And health is no exception, as well as mental health. Google has recorded a massive spike in mental health words on Google Search and on Google Assist over the past year. And so they've teamed up with Safe Space, a corporate mental health service, to find out ways how together they can tackle mental health. So I'm speaking now with Salma Al-Shahid, who's a communications and public affairs manager at Google. And it's interesting because there's just recently a wide-ranging study of the psychological impact of COVID-19 in the UAE found that more than a third of people felt their mental health had deteriorated during the pandemic. Now, this certainly seems to be reflected in the information that you found in the initiative. So, Salma, great to have you on the line with us. Thank you so much for joining us today. And I'm really curious to find out a little bit more about this initiative that Google has started and, of course, and teaming up with Safe Space. Can you take me through it, first of all, please?
Sure. Thanks for having me on the show. Like you said, there was a major spike in interest, in search interest on emotional well-being as well as mental health in the Arab world. And we also noticed, separate from Google search, we also noticed that Arabic speakers told the Arabic version of the Google Assistant that they were sad, lonely, tired, and sometimes angry millions of times in 2020 alone. The fact is that people come to the Google Assistant to share their feelings. Sometimes it's jokingly, sometimes it's seriously. So because these questions exist and happen, we thought, why not connect people with expert-reviewed and reliable information about emotional well-being? And we're very excited about that.
Now, I'm just going to break it down a little bit because I might call myself a bit of a Luddite, but what exactly, of course I know what Google is. I use it all the time. I use it every day. Mm-hmm. And all the time, as many millions of people do all over the world. But can you take me through, this was actually specifically for Google Assist, is that correct? And it's in Arabic.
Correct. It's for the Arabic version of the Google Assistant, which basically works everywhere in the world. You just need to set your language preference on your Google account to Arabic. And if you tell the Google Assistant that you're sad or you are lonely, tired, or angry, it will give you a series of recommendations and coping mechanisms based on the coping mechanisms that were drafted by Safe Space's network of licensed therapists.
Okay, and this is interesting because Safe Space, as you mentioned, it's a Dubai-based company.
Correct.
And they work with corporates, corporate mental health services, and they, I suppose, provide services to them. Now, you've joined up with them. And so can you take me through what then information will people receive once they put these words in?
So, for example, if you tell the Google Assistant that you are feeling sad, the Google Assistant will then respond, just FYI, by the way, in case no one knows, the Google Assistant understands all Arabic dialects. So if you speak to it in Egyptian Arabic or Emirati Arabic or Algerian Arabic, it will understand. However, it will reply in modern standard Arabic. So if you tell the Google Assistant that you are sad or you're feeling sad, it will recommend a series of coping mechanisms based on the responses drafted by Safe Space. So, for example, it will recommend journaling, which is a very well-known coping mechanism that is often recommended by experts. It will also recommend that you move your body, get in some exercise, and it will go as far as saying 20 minutes of walking counts as exercise. But at the end of the day, after every response, the Google Assistant will also tell people to seriously, if their feelings are quite powerful, to seriously consider seeking expert help, because at the end of the day, this does not, you know, we're not trying to replace the work of professional mental health care providers, but rather just simply connect people with expert reviewed information.
Okay, I see. So it will give you the information, but does it actually direct you, as you mentioned, to specific websites and things like that? Or will it just give you some helpful hints, tips and advice?
It will give you some helpful hints and advice. However, I'm not sure if you've used the Google Assistant before, but usually after the Google Assistant has given its response out loud, there are these things at the bottom of the screen that are called suggestion chips. One of the suggestion chips are going to be look for more information online. And if someone presses or clicks on that, it will redirect them to a series of search results that have been reviewed, obviously, and are high quality search results related to the topic.
And the search results themselves, are they then vetted also by Google, or how do they come up? Are they random depending on the country, or are they dependent on the exact words that are used? How is it that those particular recommendations or whatever would come up?
So since the recommendations will appear on the Google Assistant, right, it's not going to redirect the person using this to the Google app or a browser, but rather it will stay on the Google Assistant. And when we recommend websites on the Google Assistant, it's often based on things like the quality of the website. Obviously, it's all automatic, but it's our algorithms. You know, as you know, we've invested so much time and years, and we have some of the world's brightest minds working on making sure we're surfacing the best quality information to people. And these algorithms often depend on the quality of the website, how often people visit the website, is it an authoritative website? So you're more, for example, if you're in the UK, you'd probably get an NHS website. If you're in the UAE, you'd probably get, you know, a Ministry of Health website, or you'd get another website from a leading mental health clinic or organization in the country. So yes, definitely, the results depend on where you are.
Mm. Yeah, this is great because, you know, we need to obviously be sure that what is appearing is not spam, it's actually information that is going to be relevant and helpful. I mean, think, you know, when you everyone always says don't Google it, doctors particularly, but of course we always do. I mean, that's the you know, that's the honesty of it. I think everyone does Google whatever they get, aches, pains, all sorts of different issues, but we need to understand, or we need to sort of be aware that what will come up is reliable and relevant and will not take us further down some sort of rabbit hole of further anxiety, which can oftentimes also happen. So you're saying that it is very much vetted due to algorithms and things like that, that these websites that then would come up will, of course, be of some help.
Of course. And more importantly, it's really important that people understand that when they're looking up any health-related query on Google Search, obviously, they vet the website itself. We always recommend that for any mental health or any health-related search query, to always consult a physician and an expert, because at the end of the day, Google is a search platform, right? It's in no way trying to be, you know, a health directory, but rather we're just trying to help people get more information in the fastest and best way possible.
Healthy Habits
on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Good afternoon. I'm Siobhan Layden. I'm sitting in for Helen Farmer for the rest of the week. We're going to continue our conversation with Salma Al-Shahid. She's the Communications and Public Affairs Manager at Google. She's been really filling us in on this really interesting new initiative that Google has commenced with a Dubai-based company called Safe Space. And what it does really is help on Google Assist those that may be Googling words such as related to mental health words. And Salma, just take us through a little bit of those, maybe you've just joined in the conversation today, just to go over again a little bit about what it's about. And also want to just stress that at the moment it's just in Arabic, isn't it?
Correct. So basically, these responses are designed to help people take better care of their emotional well-being. So it's not just mental health, but it's also general emotional well-being. And right now, the feature is only available in Arabic. We're working on rolling it out to more languages in the coming months.
Oh, really? Oh, that's exciting. So you think it might be in English and other languages as well soon?
Yes, definitely.
How can you gauge the success of it or the sort of impact of it so far?
So as you know, it's only been live for a couple of days for now. We're obviously, these things take some time for us to be able to know whether this is successful or not, but we often launch these features on the Google Assistant and we don't really talk about them. We just let people discover them by themselves. So honestly, we're just happy to be putting out expert reviewed and reliable information out there that is not only easy to access, but it's also easy to hear, because this makes it even more accessible to Arabic speakers around the world.
You know, I think it's really interesting. What is very interesting about the fact this initiative has taken place, and it does reflect the increasing maturity, I suppose, in attitudes towards mental health in the UAE, mm-hmm. as you mentioned. And then is it just the Arab region, or is this a global Google initiative?
So this is a language launch. So it's going to be available to anyone with an Arabic version of the Google Assistant or anywhere in the world.
Anywhere in the world. And as you said, it's only been launched the first few days, but we'll see. Hopefully we can get in touch with you perhaps at a later date and see what the impact has been.
Sure, definitely.
So once again, just tell us, so it's on Google Assist. If you mm-hmm. search in words such as mental health or sadness or loneliness or fear, these responses have been created in touch with Safe Space, which is a local Dubai-based company. And you should then get some sort of reply that will be a helpful recommendation to you by Google. Mm-hmm. And then the further step would then be to offer some sort of websites or an other space that you can find out more information about that you might be able to help yourself with.
Exactly. So the idea here is to kind of equip people with that first line of information, right? It's kind of like the most basic and also quite often impactful recommendations. What I love about these responses is that they encourage people if needed, to seek professional or expert help. So I'm really hoping that this kind of kickstarts the conversation and about mental health and kind of help destigmatize the conversation about mental health in our part of the world.
Well, thank you so much. It's a great initiative and we look forward to seeing more about it and also that it starts rolled out in other languages as well. Salma Al-Shahed, Communications and Public Affairs Manager at Google, thanks very much for talking to us today.
Thank you. Thank you.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Join the conversation
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
And remember, you can listen to all the Dubai Eye podcasts on our website or wherever you might get your podcasts. Afternoons with Helen Farmer is live weekdays from 2 till 5 p.m.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to DubaiEye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.